from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Arthi Shahani in for Mina Kim. The Bay Area has a loud and proud music history, known worldwide for changing the way people listen, from Dave Brubeck to the Grateful Dead to Oakland rappers and hyphy. But even if you know this history, chances are you don't know the mobile DJ crews that reigned the house parties and set the stage for 1990s turntablists. Also, a look at the architecture industry, where women pursue degrees in numbers nearly equal to men, but then disproportionately don't get jobs. Join us for Forum. It's next, right after this. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Arthi Shahani, in today for Mina Kim. Before there were mobile phones, there were mobile DJs. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off of you. You'd be like heaven to touch. Oh, I want to hold you so much. As long as love has arrived. Maybe you remember roller skating to this song, Can't Take My Eyes Off of You by Boys Town Gang. You in your acid wash jeans, holding hands with that special someone under strobe lights. The 1980s were a glorious time for music. And you may not know this, but here in the Bay Area, we have to thank a community you've probably never heard of, the mobile DJs. Starting in the 1970s, there were a crop of largely teenagers in the Bay Area who played at churches and birthday parties and organically set the stage for the great battle DJs and turntablists of the 90s. To dive into this forgotten chapter in entertainment history, in the second hour of Forum, we're joined by guest Oliver Wang, a professor of sociology at California State University, Long Beach. He's contributed to NPR and the LA Times and is author of Legions of Boom, a new book about Filipino-American mobile DJ crews in the Bay Area. Oliver, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This is such an honor to be here on Forum. I'm so excited.
Bring us first into the mobile DJ scene. You have some very vivid descriptions in your book. Who was in it? What the parties compared to like today?
If I had a time machine, I'd want to go back to 1987, which is one of the largest events held during the history of this mobile scene at the San Mateo Fairgrounds. And they had something, I think there's about two dozen crews on the bill. It was housed inside of a hangar-sized, structure at the fairgrounds, and they had so many crews they had to cluster them together into these sort of impromptu groups. Each of them were able to set up on different stages, and if you can just imagine a nonstop running light show, music show, where one crew would perform, they would finish, and then you would have to run over to another side of the building in order to catch the next crew going, and have this go on for the entirety of the afternoon and evening. And you know, to be at one of these parties was to be in the midst of a music experience, a physical experience of lighting, of just crowds of people gathered around you. And this happened every weekend for over 10 years.
Man, sounds like good times. Who were the mobile DJs?
Mobile DJs, the ones that I talk about, were mostly formed by high school teenagers. And they came out of high schools like Balboa High here in San Francisco, Westmore in Daly City, and throughout places in Vallejo, Union City, Fremont, San Jose, etc. Again, mostly the ones that I write about are predominantly Filipino-American. They got started as early as 1978, and the scene really grew throughout the 1980s.
The DJs lasted for a solid chunk of time, about 15 years, but their history didn't make waves. They're not super commercial or super political scene. How did you stumble into this topic of research?
This started back in the late 1990s. I was a music journalist. I was in graduate school, and I was also a DJ. And so, and especially if you were living in the Bay in the 1990s, you knew about people like Q-Bert, like Mixmaster Mike and DJ Apollo, all of whom were Filipino-American, all of whom were from the Bay Area, all of whom were considered to be some of the best DJs in the world. And I got really curious as to how do they get started? And so as I got to interview them as a journalist, one of the common origin stories amongst all of them is that, well, we all got started in a mobile DJ crew in the 1980s. And while there was a lot that had been written about the scratch DJs, I didn't find much at the time about mobile DJs outside of maybe one or two pieces. And as both a journalist and as a scholar, it occurred to me, here's a really good story to chase down. And that's sort of where the ball got rolling.
Hmm. We're going to play a clip from DJ Kubert in a moment. What was your impression of him? You interviewed him.
Yeah, Kubert was, it was fascinating because I knew something about his history, again, as a scratch DJ, but I had never heard about his teenage years attending Balboa High School, which was one of the epicenters of this mobile scene, and how he got started as a mobile DJ, and, you know, basically how he cut his teeth doing things like weddings and garage parties and church parties before he went on to become perhaps the, you know, the most famous turntablist in the world.
Okay, and so we're going to listen to him for a moment.
Yum, 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 yum. Got DJ Kubert on the cut. Got DJ Diss on the beat. Yeah, fresh. Got my fresh. Hey, Alfred, did you change your underwears today, huh? Tell me what's up.
Okay, we're listening to the Invisible Scratch Pickles DJing in the dark. You know, one thing that's interesting to look at is when racial or ethnic identities become relevant to a group and when that gets pushed to the background. You've mentioned that you focused on Filipino DJs, but they didn't really identify collectively as Filipino really until you started pointing that out to your subjects.
Yeah, I was surprised by that because I think as someone as a DJ who myself, I came up during the 1990s, and especially because of the influence of hip-hop and the politicization of that music and culture, ethnic and racial identity was far more at the forefront of that. But with these DJs in the 1980s, that really wasn't part of how they saw their own scene. So while they realized that, yes, the parties that we go to, the people who attend, the people who are in our crews were all Filipino or predominantly Filipino-American, they never saw the scene or their activity as being somehow Filipino in expression. It was just part of, you know, not so much coincidental, but it just wasn't foremost at the forefront of their identity. What for them, their identity was around being DJs and around throwing parties and throwing good parties. Ethnicity was, you know, part of that, but it wasn't really at the forefront. It wasn't something that they wore proverbially or literally on their sleeve.
And, you know, to go a step further, what do you make of that? Why wasn't it that?
I think it's a combination of a few things. One is just their age. I mean, these were, again, high school teenagers. A lot of them got started before they were even old enough to drive to their own gigs. And I think that the identity politics and music in the 80s, that certainly shifts by the end of the 80s because of hip-hop. But these guys are getting started in an era before hip-hop has really, you know, broadened itself nationally. And so for them, music doesn't necessarily – I mean, they're spinning everything from disco and funk to Latin freestyle to modern rock and then early hip-hop. So they're really drawing from a variety of sources, none of which necessarily tie themselves to a particularly kind of ethnic identity.
Right. And so in some sense, it's like they were part of a movement that they didn't realize they were a part of. They thought they were just kind of spinning.
In a sense. I mean, I think at some point they must have realized, well, there's a lot of us out here. We're all doing the same thing. We're all competing and collaborating with one another. But I think had this same scene manifested in the 1990s, I think you might have seen a slightly, you know, a different take on ethnicity then. But I think partly because of the 80s, and a lot of it is just because they're young. I mean, I didn't have a real strong sense of ethnic identity myself. I'm Chinese American. When I was in high school, it wasn't really until I got into college and was in my 20s. So I think it's probably a confluence of a lot of those things.
KQED Arts has put together a list of the top five tracks born from the Bay Area's Filipino mobile DJ scene. You can find a list on our website, kqed.org/forum. You know, in describing Oliver Wang, in describing the job of a DJ, you actually lay out an entire theory about power. I did not expect to find that in reading your book. You even, you know, talk about Emil Durkheim, 19th century sociologist. Mm-hmm. He didn't live to see the modern discotheque, but he would have recognized the dynamics. Explain that theory of power a bit.
Well, what Durkheim writes about is this idea of collective effervescence, which is an idea that he took observing religious rituals where you have a collectivity that are joined together in these different rituals, and the, you know, the energy of that ritual itself, because you have this grouping of bodies together, eventually builds and builds, and you achieve this sort of climactic moment. And that sounds really familiar to anyone who's been out dancing and you're in a group of people, and throughout the course of the evening, that energy, that chemistry builds and builds until it hits this moment where you know, there's something, call it magical if you want, but there is this moment where everything kind of, you feel bonded to everyone. And there's a very powerful collective, you know, glue that ties people together. I think DJs are part of the, you know, the conductor, the orchestrator of that experience is, you know, night in, night out, at clubs, at bars, wherever they're spinning throughout, not just the country, but the world. And so the power relationship is partially that the DJ's in control. They get to pick what the music is, they pick how to mix it, but it's control that's given to them by the crowd. If you're DJing and no one wants to dance to what you're playing, it's really questionable if you're in control of anything. So it's really a symbiotic relationship between yourself and the audience, the dance crowd, basically, where they trust you to play the music they want and you trust them that they'll stay on the dance floor if you play the right songs.
Are you also speaking from personal experience?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've definitely killed the floor in both good and bad ways in the past. So there is that mutual trust where you have to kind of bring each other along throughout the course of that evening. And you hope you can just sort of keep the groove going and keep them on the floor.
Did you learn anything in interviewing the mobile DJs about methodology here? How to do it?
Not necessarily. I think to me, the most interesting thing was just thinking about DJing as a collective activity. And certainly I was mentored and I had people that I learned a great deal from. But I think the modern idea of the DJ is much more as a solitary figure, right? And in doing the research on these mobile DJs, the collectivity of it really became foremost to, you know, in my that's to me the most interesting thing, the idea that they would form into groups with one another, and that the social aspect of DJing and going out and doing these parties was to me one of the most resonant things about the story.
If you'd like to join the discussion, tell us about a favorite DJ of yours, what made him or her so good, or maybe you've DJed yourself or you'd been to one of those mobile DJ parties back in the day. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. You know, one question I have just by way of comparison, when you talk about that power dynamic, you know, one DJ I know of today, for example, is Skrillex, pretty famous guy.
Mm-hmm.
How do the mobile DJs that you studied in the Filipino community how do they compare in terms of the relationship with the audience?
I don't know if there would be a huge difference. I think the basic act of DJing is about establishing, you know, I went back to this metaphor of trust before. It's about establishing this idea, this level of trust between yourself and the audience. And it doesn't matter if you're spinning EDM like Skrillex does, or you're spinning hip hop, or you're spinning old soul music. Ideally, what you want is to get into a situation where you have enough people on the floor who trust you and they're willing to go along and stay on the floor and give you the energy that it's going to take for you to get through those 4, 6 hours, 8 hours of DJing. And so I think that basic act doesn't change regardless of the music or necessarily the times. So music styles change. The technology of DJing changes. But in the end, DJing is about playing music for a group of people. And I think that basic dynamic has always been the same.
Who are some of the people you encountered in your research who, you know, left an impression for you? Name a person that we haven't heard of.
I mean, one of my favorite people to interview would probably be the Go-Go's, which was one of the very, very few, perhaps the only all-female Filipina group that came out of this scene in the 1980s. And they got started mostly at Balboa High School here in San Francisco. And they were around for about, I think, 6 months to a year, and were, you know, went out and did gigs. They participated in battles. Some of them had to sneak out of their own house in order to go to their own gigs because they lived in relatively kind of traditional patriarchal families where all the daughters had curfews that their brothers didn't have. And I think it's just kind of a remarkable story about how they came and went within that scene.
So I remember as a teenager jumping out of the fire escape to go clubbing, not to DJ. Sorry, mom and dad, now you know.
Right.
But that's what they were doing to.
Yeah, maybe not as many fire escapes out here in the Bay Area. But that said, yeah, they would basically have to sneak out of their own house to go to their own gigs.
Let's hear Lookout Weekend, one of the songs that is your favorite.
I mean, she opens up talking about fog machines and laser lights, and that kind of gives you an idea of exactly what that scene would have looked and felt like.
Lookout Weekend, because weekends were
a And so why is that one of your favorites? Why does it encapsulate this era?
Just because of, I mean, number one, it was a big song during this era. So Lookout Weekend would have been one of the kind of go-to hits in, you know, I guess 1983, 84, I suppose. But also just if you listen to what Debbie Deb's talking about, she's trying to paint a picture of what that, the feel of that weekend party would look like. So again, the fog from the fog machine, the lasers and the lights cutting through it. All of, I think everything about it captures just a moment in time about what this scene looked and sounded like.
Wasn't the Beastie Boys DJ Mixmaster Mike somehow related to this scene?
Yeah, Mixmaster Mike, Filipino-American. He grew up partially in San Francisco, partially in Sacramento. He was in a mobile crew called High Tech, and it was around that time when he was in high school that he met Q-Bert, who was in a mobile crew called Lifestyle Productions, and then also DJ Apollo, who he was friends with, who was in Daily City, and he was in a mobile crew called Unlimited Sounds. And so these three core guys, Q-Bert, Mixmaster Mike, Apollo, all Bay Area DJs, all Filipino-American, all got their start in mobile crews before they got together and created the Invisible Scratch Pickles.
Great. KQED Arts has put together a list of the top five tracks born from the Bay Area's Filipino mobile DJ scene. You can find our list on our website at kqed.org/forum. And again, listeners, if you want to join this discussion, you've DJed, you have a favorite DJ, you remember this era, you want to talk about it, give us a call, 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. Albert, you point out in your book that the mobile DJ spanned late 70s to the mid 90s. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty big spread in music.
Yeah.
How did you see it evolve over that period of time?
I think the musical taste of the DJs would have obviously shifted when they first started in the late 70s. You're still in the heart of the disco era. By the time you get into the 80s, they would have been spinning more like Latin freestyle. So Debbie Deb would have been part of that movement. You have electro music coming out of L.A., hip-hop coming from New York. Really, by the late 1980s and into the 90s, hip-hop becomes the dominant musical style because it is such a DJ-friendly and DJ-centric music as well. I think in terms of the scene, outside of just the musical aspects, it was also about figuring out how to throw bigger and better parties. And so the book Legions of Boom is named after this alliance of five different crews who collaborated with one another to share equipment and to throw bigger events called the Legion of Boom. And this involved crews from across the Bay Area. And so I think this part of this idea that we can collaborate and share equipment and build these huge sound systems, this becomes much more of a core priority, you know, by the mid-1980s, because everyone's trying to compete with each other in terms of how can you put on a bigger and better show than the person next to you. And so that competitive spirit drives these increasing sound systems and the sort of sophistication of both the mixing and the lighting shows.
And where were these parties as they were getting from smaller to bigger?
A lot of them took places in, you know, you think about a lot of suburban spaces that got retasked. And this scene was largely predominantly in the suburbs. So places like Daly City and the Avenues in San Francisco, Union City, Fremont, Berryessa in San Jose. It could be anywhere from someone's garage. So garage parties were a big part of it because that was an easy, you know, gig that you could first land. You would have, you know, school gymnasiums, church halls were huge. And eventually, you know, larger facilities like I think it's gone now, but California Hall had one of the first big parties in 1979. I mentioned earlier the San Mateo Fairgrounds hosted what was probably the largest event in 1987.
We're going to take a call now from Antonio. Okay. In a moment. In terms of Daly City, it was interesting. I did not realize it's like a national hub, capital of Filipino Americans. Talk about how migration shaped up the scene.
A lot of so part of the precondition that allowed this scene to happen was the changes in the Immigration Act of 1965, which finally allowed, it ended decades of an immigration moratorium. And so tens of thousands of Filipino-American families began moving to the Bay Area, by the 1970s. A lot of them initially land in south of Market, the Mission District in San Francisco, but the ones who had middle-class means would then make a secondary move out to places like like Daly City because they could find a single family home there that was affordable. At least back then it was affordable. and so Daly City, for a variety of reasons, there was a large hospital there that employed a lot of Filipino nurses. Once you have this kind of critical mass of Filipino families already living there, that becomes an attraction in and of itself for other families to want to move there. And so that's sort of how Daly City becomes what eventually was described as the adobo capital of the USA. For that reason, Daly City is very much one of the key, hubs of this scene.
Interesting. Now we're going to go to caller Antonio from Santa Clara. Antonio.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's your question?
Okay, so this is one of the best forum programs I've heard in a long time. One of the amazing things about this whole scene is that, like, back in 78, out in South San Jose, now and then, we were making mixtapes and bringing ghetto blasters, which may not be the proper term for a boombox, but I prefer it. We were popping and locking. We would go on, field trips and have battles against other schools, and it's a huge cultural movement. And I just appreciate the show. And if there's Tom Tom Club, Alice DJ, there are so many great songs that have been put out and really appreciated, and I think it's just wonderful. That's all.
Thank you very much, Antonio. We're also going to go to Joey from Daly City. Joey.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I just wanted to add one of the DJs that really influenced me during the 80s, late 80s, early 90s was Cameron Paul. He was from Barry. He was on KML on 106. Back in the day, he used to do a lot of mixing where he would, take two live crew, a lot of Miami bass songs or Miami bass. He kind of had that Miami bass sound, and he would mix that kind of genre of music, two live crew, MC Shy D, stuff like that.
And Cameron Paul was actually, even before he was at KML, he used to be a DJ at a really influential nightclub in San Francisco called Studio West. And a lot of the pioneers who came out of San Francisco and Daly City in the late 70s and early 80s used to sneak into Studio West just to see Cameron Paul spin. So, and Paul, coincidentally, also grew up in Daly City as a young person. And so he becomes this really interesting figure within the scene, someone who's not Filipino-American, but was hugely influential on several generations of Filipino DJs, as the caller points out.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, really quickly, on line one, Dingus from Daly City. Make it quick.
Hello. Hi, this is Dingus from Daly City.
Yes.
Oliver, I picked up your book. I love it. You talked a little bit about social currency and how Filipino Americans and DJs used it, and that's why they got into DJing. My specific question is, how does that apply to, say, bedroom DJs today? Is there anything of a sort, or do DJs get to do that sort of thing today since the landscape has changed?
Very quickly.
I think that's pretty consistent, which is the idea that partly why you want a DJ is because DJs are at the center of attention in parties or in performances. And the idea that the same kinds of things that would pull someone toward the turntables in 2015, I don't think are really that much different than what might have happened in 1975 or 1985.
We were joined this half hour by Oliver Wang, a professor of sociology at California State University, Long Beach, and author of Legions of Boom, a new book about Filipino-American mobile DJ crews in the Bay Area. Thanks for being part of our program.
My pleasure.